So before we start the summer edition of Dirt Church Radio, we just need to tell you quickly that we are supported by the most amazing companies and clubs: Wild Things, Ultra Spire, Scott Running, and Further Faster, the best independently owned sportswear, outdoors wear, sportswear doesn't even begin to cut it, in the known universe. And please go and support them this summer. If you need gear, if you need the best packs, the best shoes, the best sense of community, or indeed anything for outdoor use, these are the people that you need to see.
True.
It goes something like Further Faster there in Christchurch. Rocky is hairy and so is Badger. Jules is nice and Jacob is delicious. Go to Further Faster now.
Oh, Further Faster there in Christchurch. Rocky is hairy and so is Badger. Jules is nice and Jacob is delicious. Go to Further Faster now.
Dirtchurch Radio.
Episode 225, Eugene.
We made it. We made it.
We did. And yeah. Welcome to the first of our holiday season specials. We always do this. We have a couple of weeks off at Christmas, and we thought that we would take this time to get into it with some of our greatest hits of the year. But yeah. I'm still, speaking of greatest hits, how good was Andrew McDowell's Christmas jingle for our special?
Well, it seemed like he had a bit of a late run at the Christmas number one. Did you see he had requests for it?
He had requests.
If you haven't heard that jingle, go back and listen to the start of our previous episode. Andrew McDowell, the wonderful fourth Beatle, fifth Beatle, whatever, produced a, out of the blue, we didn't know he was doing it, this wonderful jingle, Christmas jingle, and yeah, he got requests afterwards. So, I don't know, watch that, watch those Spotify numbers climb. Anyway, this week, a bit of a collab. Yeah, we've got an interview that the one and only Ruth Croft did with the team at the Between Two Beers podcast a wee while back. And we heard it and thought, you know what? As many times as we've had Ruth on DCR, this is something that DCR listeners would love to hear. Look, there's plenty that I learned about Ruth, including her trucking days. And she also throws some shade our way as well, so it's only fair that we play this episode. But look, we just want to say a huge thanks to our mates at Between Two Beers, Stephen Holloway and Seamus Martin. If you haven't heard Between Two Beers before, we'd encourage you to take a listen. They do some really great deep dive interviews with some really interesting people. And this episode with Ruth is kind of evidence of that.
Yeah, fantastic. Great to see, you know, Kiwi podcasts doing great things. And yeah, as I said, as Eugene said, it's a fantastic conversation. But first, look, we wanted to keep up the greatest run ever slot because we know it's so damn popular and we couldn't not have it during the break. So, greatest run ever, which is the part of the show where we ask you to write into us, even over summer, and tell us your greatest run ever. It doesn't have to be a race or a mountain summit. It might just be a run around the block. Something that sung to you for some reason. Send them in to us at dirtchurchradio@gmail.com. This is from Rich Lyons, and he starts off by stating, "I am not a runner. I've never really enjoyed running, but in my early 20s I ran a couple of half marathons, more out of boredom than anything, as my older sister was an avid runner at the time. Fast forward 9 years and I'd only been for 2 or 3 5K runs in almost a decade. Then I started a new role for work, and the culture was very inclusive, with plenty of banter and cheeky sledging concerning all things fitness, and before long, a work run club was formed. After just a few months, our run club had 20 to 30 members running at lunch with colleagues or in the evenings to edge up the rankings on our Strava. Run club leaderboard became a regular occurrence." Nothing like a bit of peer pressure, right? Over the next 12 months, my colleagues and I would do the occasional fun run or half marathon and a run around Auckland, and it dawned on me that I'd never attempted a full marathon and it was time to get the monkey off my back. It was early 2020, I'd just turned 35, and my sights were set on the Auckland Marathon later in the year. The goal was set, and in true fashion, I told my work colleagues that I'd signed up, and as the date got closer, I informed everyone of my goal to keep myself accountable to train and avoid the embarrassment of coming up short. In the lead up, I consumed myself with all things running, learning about injury prevention, fueling techniques, speed and hill training, negative splits, and simply focused on building a solid base. I listened to every running podcast and was also introduced to Dirt Church Radio at this time by a friend. Is every running podcast and Dirt Church Radio. Yep. I spoke with everybody that I knew who completed the marathon and asked them what they would do differently if they ran it again to slowly develop my own recipe for success. A shout out to my former colleague and ultra runner Tracy Benjamin, who gave me such a great steer to plan for the big day and encouraged me to trust my training and stick to executing my plan. As the weeks got closer, it was common knowledge around the office that I was aiming for a time of 3 hours and 45 minutes for my first marathon attempt, but to a few close friends, 3 hours and 40 minutes would be my perfect race if I managed to execute on the day. After 11 weeks, 42 runs, and 460 kilometers on the clock, I was ready. The bag drop was done, the gun went bang, and I was off. The scene at dusk was incredibly calm, and just thousands of runners side by side wanting to give it their all as the sun started to rise over Rangitoto. Running through the streets of Devonport was great. I paced myself and held back the entire time, smiling as I let hundreds of runners pass me while I kept telling myself, negative splits, negative splits. Passing a colleague at Smales Farm who simply shouted, "Stick to the plan, Rich, stick to the plan," just spurred me on, and it was a relief to get over the bridge and head back towards Victoria Park to approach the halfway mark. The next 9 kilometres just cruised by as I slowly edged up my pace to capitalise on the reserves that I had banked for the first half. By 30 kilometres, I'd finally caught up to the official pacer for my goal time. I'd been told by so many that the race doesn't start until you reach 30 kilometres, so for the first time in the race, I put on my music and settled in. It was business time. At the 34 kilometre mark, I experienced some minor cramp for 20 seconds, but I pushed through as I ran to the beat. The feeling of running at the pace you had trained for, supported by so many random strangers in the crowd on a beautiful sunny day, was simply magical. On target for 3 hours and 39 minutes, it was somewhat comical that I cramped one more time and had to stretch out my calves on the side of the road for 60 seconds. From then on, I sprinted at a tempo pace towards the CBD. The last 1 kilometre was electric. I was passing people left and right and the centre as the crowd stared and cheered on the chap in the headphones that was sprinting home. Quite the contrast to the other tired faces who had come out of the block storming in the first half of the run. The final sprint on the Vic Park grass was tiring, and as I came around the final bend, I saw my wife and 3 daughters cheering me on. I crossed the line at my goal pace and finished in 3 hours 40 minutes. I was absolutely spent, but absolutely stoked. Some 18 months later, after my perfect race in early 2022, I realized the importance of this race to me. My first marathon had given me so much confidence and strength on how to approach my running and life's obstacles. So much so that I was about to begin this year training for my first ultra, the Taupo 50K, which was cancelled, as we all know, due to COVID. But instead, my family's life was turned upside down when we tragically and unexpectedly lost one of the closest people in our lives, leaving a gaping hole in our hearts. The world stopped, everything stopped, and of course the running stopped. Not a single run for 3 months as we struggled to adjust to our new normal. Fast forward to today, and I've been back running again for 2 months. I've run a couple of small trail runs, and the training has once again begun for the Taupo Ultra. When I look back to how far off course I was this year, and how far there still is to go, I realise that my race was almost 18 months ago. My first marathon, my greatest run ever, has given me the strength to continue, the strength to face times of struggle and adversity, but also the courage to change things, to chase things that you enjoy. I am now a runner.
Wow, Rich.
And he says here, PS, my race pack is still an ultra virgin, and it was a gift from the person we lost far too soon. So maybe there is another greatest run ever in the horizon in the not too distant future. I sure hope so.
Yeah, we sure hope so too, Rich. And man, life is a marathon, eh?
It certainly is.
Life is a marathon.
Yeah.
You know, just as in those marathons, when you go up, you have your ups and downs. That's a cliche, and that's terrible and toy and everything, but it's true, isn't it?
It's 100% true. It's 100% true.
Mm. Thank you, Rich. And thank you to everyone who sent in the greatest run ever of 20, throughout the past year. We know we're still dealing with a backlog because so many of you, we were so enthusiastic with that. So we're getting our way through them, and that's why we're going to keep them up during the summer season. But yeah, keep sending them in, dirtchurchradio@gmail.com.
Okay, on with the interview, the one and only Ruth Croft. We don't need to tell you who Ruth Croft is. You already know, and if you don't know, you're just about to find out. This is an interview from our mates at the Between Two Beers podcast from last year, and it was so good we wanted to share it with you. So with their permission, here are Stephen Holloway and Seamus Martin with the one and only Ruth Croft.
Dirtchurch Radio.
Ruth Croft, welcome to Between Two Beers.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, we've taken a while to pin this down, so yeah, I'm stoked we've made it happen.
Hey, you've been quite busy. I feel like, you know, you've had a little bit on your plate. We're excited to have you in. Are you currently in Taiwan at the moment? How long have you been there for and what's the go over there?
Yeah, so I arrived here just under a week ago. I lived in Taiwan for 5.5 years, and I think it was mid-October they stopped quarantine, so you could finally, foreigners could finally get back in. And so, yeah, I'm still supported through Garmin. They're one of my sponsors out of Taiwan, and I've got a lot of friends still here, so it's kind of on my way back to New Zealand, but kind of stopping off here for just a week.
Are you in season? Is there a running season? Where are we at in terms of, like, we're near the end of the calendar year, so is that in line with, like, a running season?
Yeah, so the kind of northern hemisphere running season starts around May, and then the last races are kind of now, and then obviously the New Zealand season's kind of just starting to kick off, and we'll go through till about March, April. It's kind of funny, like, trail running's in a big boom at the moment, and I feel like the season every year is just getting a little bit longer and a little bit longer.
So does that mean Taiwan, you're off the feet? Like, are you just relaxing, or is there any part of you that, do you go for a little run, or how's it look?
So I finished my last race in France 3 weeks ago, and I get to the end of the season and I'm pretty burnt out, to be honest. And so I hadn't run for 3 weeks, so completely no exercise at all and just really no desire to either. So I kind of just like to feel that out and just do nothing. And then slowly you kind of get your mojo back and kind of want to get back into some training. And so yesterday I went for my first run back. And then today, actually, I've got a really good Taiwanese friend, and I used to train with him a lot when I was here. And he's currently training for the Yukon Arctic Circle Trail, which is 430 miles self-supported. And minus 20 degrees. And he's done it before, and so he's going back to do it again, and obviously he needs to train. And so his decision was to run around Taiwan. So he's going to do 850K towing a sled with wheels on it. And so I went and joined him this morning for about 20K, and then I've actually just seen one of his wheels blown.
the nonchalant nature of I just joined him for my first run back. It was a 20K. I think for people that might not know who you are and what you do, that is a jarring kind of introduction to where we might head in this episode. A casual 20K after 3 weeks of not running. Pretty impressive, Steve.
Yeah, when you're saying things like that, do you realize the sort of absurdity of I imagine the characters you hang out with in your line of work or your job or running are extreme animals. Like, are you attracted to those sort of people? Is that why you're like linked up with this guy?
Yeah, they're kind of my tribe, I'd say. And like, I hang out with them. Like, when I leave New Zealand, I'm essentially hanging out with a lot of runners. And so everything is very normalized. So running an ultra, which is anything over 42K, like running 100K, 100 miles, like even some people do 200 miles. And like my friend Tommy doing 420 mile races, like, yeah, it just becomes normal until you talk to someone who is not from the scene, and then you kind of step back and you're like, you do see it differently. You're like, yeah, I would say it's pretty messed up.
Like, yeah, messed up is a good way to put it. We're gonna get into the running stuff, but I'm gonna try and paint a little bit of picture, show people who Ruth Croft is. So what we do between Two Bears, we try to dig around and ask a few people some interesting stories, which might be entertaining. And we have gone to a friend of yours, Josh Coman. And now he's given us a few bits, and I'm not really sure where it goes or if they're even good yarns, but we'll try it out. So he said, I said, what should we ask Ruth about? And she said, ask her about the time she bought round a curry for dinner.
I think this was last year. It wasn't even that old ago. So Josh obviously was one of the best 800 meter runners in New Zealand, and then got acute myeloid leukemia, and so that kind of put a stop to everything. And he's actually had cancer twice. Like, you hear, I don't know if you've listened to any of his podcasts, but he's had cancer twice, heart attacks, like had a stem cell, what is it, stem cell like transplant, and then after that got graft versus host disease. Like, he's just been through the ringer. And so he's now allergic to kiwi fruit, and he can't eat anything oh no, this is a different curry story.
Something about a frozen curry. Amazing. Amazing. Oh,
I was like, this was just last year. Like I made a curry and it was way too hot for him. And then I'm like, oh no, this is a different curry story, which was like 2 years ago. And I invited my partner and I invited his now wife, Sybil and Josh for dinner. And we'd gone and run Goat's Pass and we were like wrecked and like super late getting home, and we were stopping by through my parents' place on the way to where we were staying, and we didn't have dinner essentially. And so I just like went through my parents' freezer and found a curry, like a green curry that had been made. And so I was like to my partner, oh, we just take that, we'll just give them that. They won't know. And then we had dinner, and then Sybil kept saying, oh, this is a great curry, Ruth. Like, how'd you make this? And I didn't make it. It was actually my sister who made it. And I kind of tried to bluff my way through it. And then, like, Sybil was just being, like, really persistent about it. And then I just had to say, I was like, look, I didn't make the curry. And then they were just, like, calling me out on that. So that's the curry story.
From listening to a few podcasts and hearing interviews and things, I know you're such a humble, nice person. So I can imagine sort of having to lie about something which is even as small as a curry would have been incredibly awkward and difficult.
Well, I just thought I'd get away with it. I was like, oh, yeah, just tell them that I made it. Just claim it. And then, yeah, that was too persistent about it.
I loved the detail of the first story, and then that moment just when the penny dropped about, oh no, actually, it's probably the frozen curry story.
The other one he's given us is jumping off Brunner Bridge, which is 18 meters high. Is there a story behind that?
Yeah, so when I like growing up on the coast, like I would say, not a lot of people ran, and so I kind of got hooked up with Eddie Gray, who was in 1971, he got third at the World Cross Country Champs. And I was probably about 15 when I got introduced to him, and he was going down a different hole, rabbit hole now. He was probably in his 60s. And so I was kind of like showed up and thought, well, yeah, he's in his 60s, probably a bit over the hill. And went for a run with Eddie, and he took me up all the old mines, Spring Creek and that out by Renunga, and we got to the top of one of the mines, and I just thought I was going to throw up. I was like, there's no way, like, I'm going to even make it home. And made it home, and then he's like pretty old school, doesn't own a car, and doesn't own a cell phone, I don't think even. I think he does now, actually. And then, like, he complains, like, if you want to find any running results these days, you've got to have one of those computer things, and just super old school way. Anyway, Josh and I, we used to run a lot with him, and they'd be on a Sunday. And then on the way home, we'd stop off at the Brunner Mine Bridge and jump off that, which you go off the lower part. It was like 14 meters, but then we'd climb to the top and jump off that. And it's actually pretty decent. It's 18 meters, which now I think back, and I'm like, it was actually really stupid to do something like that. Could go wrong. And then one day we decided we wanted to know exactly how high it was, so we took a tape measure. One of us was up the top and one of us was down the bottom measuring it. So that's the Brunner Mine story.
Is that something as an adult that you ever head back home and jump off these days?
Well, it was kind of like your initiation if you came to the coast. It was like if we had friends that would come, we'd take them to the Brunner Mine Bridge and make them jump. Because my sister actually made me jump on my 12th birthday. And so my partner came back from France, his first time on the coast, and we took him to the Brunner Mine. And he didn't dare jump off the top, but he got off the bottom. So we're like, ah, you can stay around then. We won't ship you back to France just yet.
Gold. We're going to talk more about some of those old school West Coast guys a little bit later. But I wanted to start with a bit of mentality chat. Now, ultra marathons and 100-mile races seem to me to attract the toughest minds in the world. It seems like you're forever working to improve your mindset and your mentality. I was hoping you could talk to us a little bit about your meditation journey and your experience with silent retreats and how that kind of worked into your life now.
Yeah, so I think it was 2018. I was over in Europe. It was the end of the season, and I was just at that point. I don't know if you've ever had it where you just feel like you're really stagnant, like you haven't done anything that's challenged you for a long time. I wasn't running really long ultras at that point, and my sister had done Vipassana, which is the 10-day silent meditation So how that works is, 10 days silent meditation where you meditate for 10 hours per day. You're not allowed to read, write, talk, like eye contact and hand gestures aren't even allowed. You're not allowed to exercise. You're not allowed to do like yoga. So you're not allowed to do anything that distracts you from essentially doing inner work. And so I was, really stagnant and decided like, right, I need to do something that challenges me. And so I decided I was going to do Vipassana, but Vipassana actually has become really popular. It's like, it's the same technique. Essien Goenka kind of founded it, and it's taught throughout the world at different centers. And how it works is that when you go to it, you, like when you finished it, you give a donation on what you thought you got out of it or how much you could like afford at the time. And your donation essentially helps the next people coming through to be able to have that retreat. And so, I was on the online looking for a retreat center, and obviously they were all full except for in Sri Lanka. And so I booked a flight to Sri Lanka and then went to this retreat center. And it was probably, I'd say, one of the hardest things I've ever done, because I think we never taught growing up like how our mind operates or the stories that we are constantly telling us ourselves, like that narration that's always happening. And all the time we start identifying with what's being told in our minds. And so, it was pretty crazy. That first 3 days, you're thinking of absolutely every excuse not to be there, like just how you could get out. And then I think it was like on the fourth day, you sit down and then everything is just silent. And and so after it's definitely hard, it doesn't get easier, but like some days all you're hanging out for is the bell that tells you that it's lunchtime. You only have one meal a day too, actually, but everything, you come out of it, and for me personally, with my experience, I come out of it, it's like life is just on a brighter colored filter. You slow down completely. You have a chance to kind of strip back like all the noise, like what's not really important in life, and just come back, kind of center yourself, I would say. But it was trickier that in Sri Lanka, because like the facility was, you were pretty much at a concrete bunker, had a squat toilet, and obviously had rats and had cockroaches coming up your drain at night. And one of the things is you shall not harm. And so I had like a broom, like trying to kill these cockroaches. And so that kind of added like another dimension to it. But every year since, at the end of the season, I go and kind of try to shut off from everything and do a retreat of some sort.
Does that get easier each time that you do it? Like you mentioned the kind of day four situation there, but the second and third and fourth times that you do it, does day four become less of a hassle and it becomes an easier thing to do?
No, it doesn't. So far for me, it hasn't. It's always kind of, because like I do meditate through the year, but it kind of ebbs and flows. And so sometimes by the end of the year, my practice has kind of slipped away a bit. So you're kind of starting a bit back at the beginning. But it doesn't get easier, because like in our everyday life, we just have so many distractions. Like we've got our cell phones, we've got emails, we've got like Netflix, we've
got podcasts.
Like, just one between two beers. But you've always got like, we're never alone. Like I feel like we've lost that ability to just sit and be and not have to be doing something. And then like this year I went and did a different one. I did a darkness retreat. So it was same kind of, you're just in a room by yourself. You didn't have a teacher or anything, and you're in complete darkness for 10 days.
What? So, okay, no, we're going to need to talk about that. That's dark. That's like people use that as torture, don't they? Like solitary confinement in the darkness. So you go to that one after you've sort of mastered the daylight meditation retreat.
I don't know. Well, my friend said like you're essentially just putting yourself kind of in a jail for 10 days. And then my other friend was like, oh, so you're doing a darkness retreat this year, so next year it's going to be no breathing retreat. Like, how's it going to work?
Yeah, where do you go from there?
is it darkness and silence?
Yeah, it's darkness and silence.
Holy moly.
And you're just by yourself in a room. Yeah.
So what are you actually thinking? Like, are you meditating the whole time? Like, I'm very vaguely familiar with the process of meditation, right? It's like thoughts come in and you kind of just, you're present and you swap them away. Is that kind of it? And are you doing that the whole time, or are you sort of figuring your life out at parts as well?
Yeah, it's a bit of everything, really. It depends on what technique you do. Like, Vipassana is about, like, scanning your body, observing, like, not reacting. Like, in Vipassana, you have three 1-hour Adihana sittings, which is where for an hour you're not allowed to move. Like, if a fly lands on you, you're not allowed to move. You're not allowed to react. Just observe. So I've kind of don't do that technique so much, but I do more like a heart centered. So just bringing your awareness into your heart. You're observing your thoughts, and if you find that they're wandering off, it's just like bringing it back to the center. I meditate a lot, but it also just gives you time to, like, think about life, like, think about the people that are important to you. You think about life, you also think about death. Like, I felt like in this darkness retreat, it was a lot of darkness figuratively and literally kind of came up. And as I said before, it just gives you space to really think about what's important, because I think when we have all these distractions, that often what's important gets buried under all the noise. That makes sense.
Yeah, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but when you come out of something like that, do you just have an overwhelming feeling of gratitude for just everyday normal things?
Yeah, you totally do. You're very much back in the present moment, and you cherish, like, any interaction you can have with people, because, yeah, that's what it's about. It's about connection and the people in your life, and not all that other stuff that we think is important when really it's not. So, yeah, it just slows everything down completely.
I'm so curious to dig away here as well, but is this something that's come on in later life, or is this something that's been a curiosity of yours that's developed over time, or has it always been there?
No, I definitely did not meditate. I did not know anything about how my mind works or that. It was just curiosity. Kind of, as I said, I was just feeling very stagnant in life and just wanted to do something that really took me outside of my comfort zone. And it scared me a lot to be sitting by myself with my mind for 10 days. And so that was kind of the catalyst for it.
In the darkness too. Yeah, so I'm fascinated by this too. I've never met anyone that's done this, but I've got so many questions about it. Like, you've got to a place now where you know you're able to survive last through a 10-day silent retreat. In the darkness, are there any moments where you're fighting a battle with your mind to just quit? Like, is that in you, or do you know you're going to see these things through no matter what?
So when I first got there, I was actually pretty exhausted because I'd just finished a race. And so I slept for the first pretty much 36 hours. You got three smoothies a day there. And so I only got up to get the smoothie and go back to sleep. And then after the 36 hours, I was going to be easy. We're already a day and a bit down. And then it kind of, like, you know, I wasn't so tired. And so you just start. I know, like, it's hard, but I've gone there to do work. So, yeah, it's just, I know I'll get through it. And I don't doubt that at all.
Is there a direct correlation, you think, to the success you've had in the last, I don't know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years running, and the increase in meditation and these silent retreats? Like, is it mastering the mind to a place where you can deal with the hardships that come on a 100-mile race?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's helped in my everyday life. Like, just when we grow up, we're very much a product of our environment. And so obviously we learn a lot from our parents, from, like, where we grew up. And I think sometimes your beliefs or values, it's kind of hard to explain. I think when you're given, like, I don't know, something that triggers you. I'm trying to think of an example, actually. Like, if you have something in life that triggers you and you just react straight away, because it's like, it's kind of in your, they call it like your default network mode. It's like in your mind where it's just like all these learned habits or beliefs. Like, you're such a creature of, like, the environment that you're in, and also, like, you get a lot of like the way you interact with the world can be influenced by also your parents. And so sometimes we're working on our default network mode, which is we're always reacting and we're not actually in the present moment. And so the way for me meditation works is that I can step back and I can be in a situation and see it a bit more neutral without falling back on my default network mode. I don't know, hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It does.
Yeah.
In these retreats, I imagine the sort of person that does a 10-day darkness retreat, like the people you mix with, not that you're going to talk to them, must be some of the most interesting people in the world. I imagine the people that go to those sort of things would just be like have an incredible outlook on life. Like, have you met some? Do you meet up with these people afterwards, or do you share time with them at other? Or is it all just a personal journey?
The first one I did, I talked with people afterwards, but it's only, you only have like half a day together. So it's not like, you get to know them super well. And then the other time, some of them I've just gone to a monastery and sat by myself, or one of them was actually online because it was during COVID. But you didn't really get to talk to people then. And then this one, it was in like a kind of like a chalet, and you were like, there were three of us in total who were doing a retreat, but people come at different times. And so while I was there, I didn't see anyone who would, and so I had no chance to interact with them.
Wait, did you say an online silent retreat?
I know.
How does that work?
just put yourself on mute and you'll be fine.
I know. But like when it's COVID, like beggars can't be choosers.
Yeah,
true. And I also think like it was, because we had a timetable and you would log in, but obviously you're not going on Facebook, you're not scrolling, you're not doing anything. You just like log in to the meditation and meditate with everyone. And then obviously, I just think like you could say to yourself, oh man, like this is online, like this isn't as good as being in person. But I was like, no, this is like, that's something you're telling yourself. That's not true. Like I can get as much out of being online as if I was there in person. So yeah, I did that for 10 days. It was again by myself, just in the Airbnb, but I had no other option really. The year of COVID. So
incredible. That's incredible mindset. That's so fascinating.
It's a phenomenal like opening 25, 30 minutes of just of like that's blown me away.
That's been captivating. Okay, so moving on. So I reached out to Eugene Bingham, who I've sort of recently developed a friendship with, and you've been on his excellent Dirt Church Road podcast a number of times. And I recommend anyone who's listening to this, go back and listen because there's some awesome episodes there. But I said, what should we ask Ruth about? And so he sent me a link to a video of a sprint finish at the Sierra Zenil race 3 years ago. So he said your West Coast competitiveness was on display, and I watched it and it was pretty incredible, to be honest. So to paint a bit of a picture for those listening, it's hailed apparently as the New York Marathon of mountain races, race of 5 4,000 meter peaks, 31 kilometer mountain trail involving 2,200 meter elevation and 1,100 meter descent. And so there you are on the home straight, sprinting and fighting and throwing elbows to try and nudge into fourth place. And the course is packed with fans on both sides. And the look on your face was just fierce. And he said that they often reference the Ruth Croft elbows. But I was like, the determination...
I did not elbow her.
I'll let the viewers judge for themselves.
We'll let that through and let's see.
But the sheer determination on that video on your face of at the end of that grueling race to have the sprint in you and the fight in you to fight for that fourth place, it really sort of blew me away. Do you remember that race well?
Yeah, because the year before I actually it was the exact same situation, but I got beaten on a sprint finish for fourth like the year before. And so like Anise, she's French, she kind of went, I saw her ahead and I was like, right, I can catch her. And so like I went past her, I think, and then she went past me. And then in my mind, I was like, yeah, you'll be happy with fifth. Fifth's good. And then kind of something kicked in. I was like, no, you can't be happy with fifth. Like, you can't let this happen again. And so I luckily found another gear, but I kind of also, looking at the video, I should have passed on the right, passed on the left, which wasn't the best. But I do remember it. And sometimes, you think you don't have another gear, but you really do.
When you say you passed on the right and you should, you passed on the left and you should have passed, is that runner's etiquette? Is that race etiquette? Are there like unwritten race rules that you need to kind of?
Yeah, I think you should pass on the right. And it was kind of like the left was in between like the cider barrier and her. And there's obviously a lot more room on the right, but we can just say I'm from the southern hemisphere, so I get a bit confused.
I feel like after some of those distances, those rules surely go out the window, and it's just get over the line. Sure,
well, it'd be quite unique to have a sprint. How rare is a sprint finish in a sort of 50k race or 31k mountain trek?
And like Sierra Zanel is a really fast trail race, and it's short and. In the sense that it's 32K. So, yeah, it's pretty common because that race is highly competitive. So it can be some pretty nail-biting finishes.
I want to link that into sort of the upbringing, where the competitiveness comes from. On the West Coast, we've already mentioned some old-school characters. Was that your childhood? Was it sort of, yeah, where did you get the competitiveness from?
I think I probably owe it to my brother. To be honest, like he was older, and I think I hope he doesn't listen to this, but I think he's a bit of a bully. I just remember like we'd always be kind of not fighting, but we're always like, yeah, competing against each other, and we'd be like out playing basketball, and he was obviously bigger than me, and then he'd just like bounce the ball backwards into towards me, and then obviously I was little, there was no way I could get the ball, and then I'd start like crying and yelling, and then he'd just kick the ball into the paddock and walk off. And so I think like it was probably him, but also our family's super competitive. And so every year we'd kind of go do a tramp like down the Copeland or some over Peninsula Bay, I think it was in Christchurch, about Akaroa. And my uncle would come with us, and we'd all had to carry our own sleeping bags and everything and food, and that we'd all hike in, and then on the last day it would just be like a sprint finish to the car. And obviously I was always dead last because I was the youngest, but I was pretty young. I think I was like 6 or 7, and I'd always be at the car crying because I was last. And I think Dad says he remembers the day that we went for a walk up the road, and I actually finally, they gave me a head start, and they didn't catch me.
It's a common theme with a lot of our successful guests that we've had on, about that younger sibling kind of mentality and always chasing that older sibling, being the youngest that gets dragged along to sports or has to compete in the backyard, and it ultimately sharpens those tools for later in life.
Yeah, I think so. It kind of makes you hungry. Yeah.
Did you always, you always did have a great motor. Did you just dominate like school cross countries and any sort of long distance races?
I wouldn't say dominate, like I was always up there, but it wasn't like, yeah, I was never winning by a lot or anything, and sometimes I wasn't winning, so, but yeah, I just did every kind of, I think it's like most Kiwi kids growing up, used to do every sport under the sun, like basketball, netball, bit of touch and tennis, and so, yeah, but yeah, I definitely didn't win everything.
Have I got it right that you went to boarding school at quite a young age? Did that also factor in? I know kids that I grew up with that when they were at boarding school would just play every sport that they possibly could to make sure that they got time away from the dorm. Was that you?
Yeah.
Was that you as well?
Yeah, that was definitely me. Yeah, I think I went to boarding school at 11. And because we had to do prep for, I think it was a couple of hours. But if you did sport, you obviously didn't have to do prep, like your homework. And so it's like, oh, is this swimming class? I'll do that. Sign me up. So,
you went to the US for college. At what age before you went did that start to appear on the radar? Like, were you in like age group New Zealand running teams and things? Did that appear? Was it like the year before? You're like, oh shit, college in America is an option, or were there other avenues that you could have gone with running?
So I started getting offers probably my last year of high school. But I wasn't really interested, or probably just not really ready. But I was actually pretty lost when I finished high school because I'd kind of focused a lot on sport and wasn't really that driven academically or had anything that I was really interested in besides running. And so I really struggled, like got pretty depressed once I left high school and didn't know what to do. And kind of my old man has a trucking company, and so every school holidays growing up, I worked for him from the age of 10, I think, or 11 full time. And so I went back home and was working for him. And then they kind of said, like, you can't stay here. Like, you need to go and get some experience or go to university. And so I decided the day before uni started that I'd go do some sport management or something at Lincoln University. So packed up my car and went over to Lincoln. And then I went to, I think it was one lecture. And then I was like, oh, this isn't for me. So I unenrolled myself and then called my old man. And he goes, oh, you bet my record, because he lasted 6 weeks at uni. And then, yeah, I had part of my truck license. And so I was obviously needed to get a job to support myself. And I found a job in Christchurch driving a truck. And then on the first day I crashed. And so I didn't have that job. And then I finally found a job working at a bar and restaurant in Christchurch. And so I went and did that for nearly 2 years. And after the first year and a half, I just started to think about the US, and I had a good friend going over there. And so, yeah, I decided it was a good opportunity to get an education and also run.
Was the hospo life conducive to running training, or did you kind of park the running training while you were pulling pints or clearing glasses on Friday, Saturday nights?
I don't think it was conducive for running, but I think it's what I needed at the time. Like, it was a really social time, met a lot of good people, kind of made me probably chill out a bit. Definitely, yeah, you started, I think it was like 4 PM, and then was finishing like Saturday, Sunday, was like 4 AM. And then we'd go for a Sunday long run at 8 AM up at the Port Hills. But when you're younger, like, you can get away with like drinking and training and kind of balancing it all. Like, I couldn't do that now, but at the time it worked. And as I said, I think it was really good for me to get out of that running kind of like super serious kind of circle and just hang out with other people who weren't runners or athletes or that.
What I think is interesting about your story is, you go to college in the US, but from what I can understand, it wasn't the springboard or the platform to kind of send you off on the trail, excuse the pun, that you're on now, right? Your college experience did it help your running?
Or
yeah, it's not my story to tell. I'm kind of setting it up.
You can just be honest.
It was shit.
I went over and I just got my first stress fracture in New Zealand and went over to the US. And then the next 4 years, I had 4 stress fractures in my femur and that. And it definitely, like, my running regressed, essentially. And I think it was my senior year until I did a PB. And then I think it was, yeah, my senior year until I ran an indoor meet. And I think it's just very different in the US, because it's, you go to the university and it's kind of like a business, really. We had over 20 girls on the team, and it was the top 7 that would travel to the meet, like the bigger meets. And as a freshman coming in, I didn't really have a lot of confidence in myself or like knowing what to do, like what was best for me at the time. And you're trying to work out your pecking order. And obviously my easy runs were too fast. And also, you come from New Zealand, where like we did all our training on a grass track. Hardly ever ran on a synthetic track, and hardly, I didn't really run on the road either. And in the US, I ran a lot on the road. And so I don't think it was the program, because like a lot of people do come into it and they do really well. It just wasn't the right fit for me. And I think like looking back on it, also I wasn't in a good headspace probably. Also, like physically, like I put on weight when I got over there. They call it the freshman 15.
I was going to ask about that, but I'm glad you said it, not me.
Well, it was like pretty tough, because they had like all you can eat buffet every night, and then they'd have these like fresh out of the oven like butterscotch cookies and like, and then also I was probably drinking a bit.
I was
going
to say the red cup parties. Were you going to those as well? And then how was your beer pong game when you were over there? Did you
flip cup?
My keg stand was pretty good.
Nice.
And my beer pong. Because it's like, that's when you go to the US and it's like, you realize your drinking, like your mentality towards drinking is just like, it's terrible. Like you go out to a party and it's like, for a Kiwi, I think it was like a lot of you drink till you can't drink no more. And then the US kind of attitude was you just drink to have a good time. And so it took a long time for me to kind of like stop that kind of attitude towards drinking.
I can see Stephen nodding in agreement because
I did 4 years at Monmouth University on a Sacra scholarship, and I found that the relationship with Americans for drinking was really unhealthy because I went over there when I was 17, 18, so I'd been having a few beers with at home with the parents and stuff. Obviously, there the drinking age is 21, so drinking for them is kind of the unknown. So everyone would just binge drink just two or three nights a week, get absolutely wasted, and I was kind of like, oh, these guys are really going for it. Not great for the soccer either.
Yeah, but it wasn't good for the running, but it was also like running wasn't going good at that point, and so I didn't want all other aspects of my life to go bad as well, so I kind of probably enjoyed the social side a lot, but probably a bit too much.
What did you actually study?
I did international business and finance.
Nice.
What distances were you running in that, like, what was the range of distances in college?
So it was, you'd do normally the track season, and for me that was the 5K normally. I did one 10K on the track, and then you'd kind of move into, I think, you'd do cross country. I think it was 8K. I can't even remember actually. I'm pretty sure it was 8K. And then you do indoor season as well, which was normally like 3K.
So I know you said you were injured, so you didn't really get a fair representation of where you stood in the team. But did you know at that stage that the longer stuff was you were better suited for, or were you good at the shorter stuff as well?
Not really. Like, I always enjoyed like Sunday long runs and all that, but I didn't, like, I would do run over Goat's Pass, and I really enjoyed that sort of stuff, or running up creases on the Paparoas and on the West Coast. Like, I would love all that sort of adventure racing, adventure running. And then obviously when I was in New Zealand, I represented New Zealand for World Juniors Athletics and cross country and also mountain running. But I love mountain running. It was always my favorite, hands down. I always struggled quite a bit with the track.
So this is where I was talking to Shay about this part of the story, which is really unique to you, because you're someone who is at the very top of the world, the best at what you do in your sport. But after that college experience, you walked away. You were done. You went to move to Taiwan, right? And you basically, at that point, you weren't in a great place, like you said, but you were done with running. And then to find your path back to running and then go on to be the best in the world is crazy. Like, I don't think you get that in any other sport. What, reflecting on that phase when you did turn your back on it, what do you think of that now?
I think, because someone actually asked me that recently, they were like, what's the thing you're most proud of in your life? And for me, it was moving to Taiwan, because it was like, I didn't know the culture, hardly knew where it was on the map, like didn't speak the language, didn't know anyone here. And for me, it was a big step. And I don't think you would ever think that moving to Taiwan, you would end up trail running or you would end up coming back full circle, because that was never my intention. Moving here, it was like, I want to do something completely new. I don't want, because up until that point, running had really been like, it had like directed a lot of my life, like moving to the States, and I didn't want it to be deciding where I went to next. And so, it's crazy how sometimes your decisions can lead you full circle.
It's a hell of a long way away from, is it Stillwater?
Yeah, you got it right.
It's a hell of a long way away from there, right? Culturally, distance-wise and everything. Like, how's the culture shock when you first arrived there?
Well, I'd been to mainland China for World Junior Athletics Champs, and, like, I loved it because it was just, it's completely different to anything I know. Moving to Taiwan, it was definitely, it's just a lot of stimulation, actually. Like, it's never quiet. There's always something going on. And obviously the first year I didn't speak any Chinese, and so like just the smallest things in your day would become very frustrating, like doing anything like opening a bank account, or it would just take all day. And then, even signing up for races, like that's kind of how I ended up into ultras as well, because I couldn't sign up in time for the 15K of the North Face. And so the 50 was the only one left and with still spaces. So I was like, I'll do that. But I think, Taiwan always will hold a kind of a soft spot in my heart, because I lived here for 5.5 years and I was just so welcomed. And Taiwanese are the most friendliest people. And yeah, I've had such an amazing experience here. And like, even I come back now and I'm like, wow, I don't know how I lived here for so long. Like, in the summer, it's just like the heat is oppressive. You have to run at 5 a.m. Otherwise you just get absolutely cooked. And I ran like 95% of my training was on a concrete river path. But when you've got good people or a good community or tribe around you, I think that's more important than like the physical place where you're living.
I don't want to brush over that detail. Like, moving to Taiwan where you don't know anyone and you don't speak the language, like, what was the game plan? Like, when you arrived, like, how did you know what to do? What was your plan?
Yeah, so I'd applied for a teaching English job, and so I'd got that. So the plan was to come and teach English. So that's what I did for the first kind of year and a half. And like, when you can come here and live in Taipei and not speak Chinese, like, there's a lot of expats, but also it's got a very like transient country. So I came here and then a lot of my friends left after the first year. And so then I joined a Taiwanese running club and then got a scholarship to study Chinese. And then after that, tried to immerse myself more in the culture. And you obviously have, I think, a way better experience once you do that.
So link us up to the professional runner. So you find your way back into running through these clubs and things and a building community. And then how many years until you're thinking, okay, I'm actually really good at this. There's a potential to actually go pro, if that's the right term.
Yeah. So as I just mentioned before, I did the North Face 50K and won that. And then after that, the North Face started sponsoring me, and it was just kit gear and that to begin with. And then I started, like, it was never, like, I never was set at that point seeing it as a career at all. I actually just wanted to travel around Asia kind of when I could and do different races. And so I signed up for, what was it? It was a 60K that started Everest Base Camp. So I did that. And then there was a race to the summit of Mount Fuji. So it was a half marathon and you finish at the top. And so I signed up for that. And then there was a race that went up and down Mount Kinabalu in Borneo. So went and did that. And then
I'm sorry. Like, how nonchalant you are about listing these things up. Like,
some of the most incredible places in the world.
Like a 10-day hike to base camp to start an ultra is just incredible. Like, that is mad. Had you tackled some of those distances prior, or like that first 51K that you signed up for, was that the longest you'd ever competed in at that time?
Yeah, it was definitely the longest, and I was super nervous about it. Did not know anything, didn't know how to hydrate, didn't know how to do nutrition, but there was actually a Kiwi guy over here that I used to train with a lot. And so I did the training, I did all the work necessary, but I was pretty ripe at that stage, like, definitely didn't know how to approach it all. Yeah. It was just like, once you're over here, there's just so many opportunities, actually, and like just crazy opportunities that... Like, I got invited to a Red Bull race in China, and it was 5 of us were invited. They wanted to have, like, the highest trail race, and I went up to Mount Uju, which was 6,200 metres, which you're obviously not running at that height. But it was pretty funny watching, because obviously you think of Red Bull, it's, like, real action-packed, and they did this video of it, and it's just, like, these 5 of us, like, death marching up this up this mountain. But just cool experiences like that, that when you're living over here, it just opens up different doors.
You're known now worldwide as one of the best long-distance runners in the world, but at what point did you realise the really big stuff was on the horizon? Like, there's a difference, right, between running a 30K, running a 50K, and doing like a 100-mile race. Like, is it all quite similar? Like, if you're good at 50K, are you going to be good at 100 miles, or is it a different mindset? I don't really know what I'm asking, but can you help me sort of paint a picture?
No, you're not necessarily like a versatile athlete and that can do them all. Because, like, trail running isn't just trail running. Like, under the trail running umbrella, you kind of have a lot of like different disciplines. And so, like, for example, you have a VK, which a VK stands for vertical kilometer. So this is super short, maybe 3 to 5K, but your accumulated ascent is 1,000 meters. So they're like full power over pretty short, like 30 minutes. And then like you'll have your mountain running races, which are kind of like the classic, like my coach, Jonathan White, was 6 times world mountain running champ. And so that's like you have either the uphill, the up and down, and that's like not very technical, super pretty runnable. And then you can have like your trail, like your sub marathon, and then obviously anything over a marathon is your ultra. Depends who you talk to. Some people say like an ultra is like 100K or above. And then you have within that also you have sky running. And so sky running is essentially like super technical races. Like you can have chains and Via Ferrata. It has to be above 2,000 meters. And then so that kind of attracts a different runner with a different skill set. And then you obviously have your 100K, and then you have your 100 milers. And then you're, even within your 100 milers, like you have people who come from more like a running pedigree, which I would say I come from. So you're good at the running kind of 100 milers. Or then you have like the super mountainous, which is like UTMB, which is 170K with 10,000 meters of climbing. And so to find like, you'd say on the scene, like Kilian Jornet is probably the most versatile athlete out there. Like he can... he can win the like Sears and Al through to UTMB. Like he's got a very wide range. So hopefully that explains a bit more.
I didn't know there were so many categories within the category. Yeah. It is amazing.
Yeah.
Like what you don't know is amazing. Like actually amazing.
Yeah.
And what is your strongest out of all of those? What's your best?
I kind of like the 50 miles, so 80K distance. Like you're running, it's like it's over. Not as well. It's because like 100 miles, like a whole day, and then like your 80K can be over, like maybe 7 hours or something, and you don't have to think about your nutrition for as long. And then your body's not as destroyed as say 100 miler. You can recover quicker. So when I first started getting into trail running, there is a lot of hype around 100 miles, and so I started doing. I started doing shorter races and then kind of pretty quickly said I want to do UTMB and like these hard 100-mile races. And so I started doing them and then just kind of realized pretty quickly that I bought into the hype and wasn't really thinking about what was I enjoyed. And so I kind of stepped back down in distance, and which I think was good because I got a bit more experience around the 40K, like around your nutrition and that 50K up to 80K, 100K. And then after I'd done a few years of those in the same circuits, I then decided to step it up and do 100 miles. Because like you end up doing a lot of the same races. And for me personally, I don't get super motivated by like year in and year out doing the same races and also racing against the same people.
It's hard to wrap your head around the distances we're talking about, 100 miles, but I want to talk about Western States because this was your biggest win, I'm thinking. And it was a few months ago, but the first time you did it, you came second and you sort of said never again. It seems like a bad experience. You did do it again and you won it, and worldwide attention, like this was a huge, big, huge deal, and congratulations because it's an amazing achievement. Talk to us about the Western States. How's that journey been?
Yeah, it's been a good journey. And I say a lot of stuff straight after running 100 miles. I think I should definitely, wait a day or two until I say any, like, concrete things like I'm never coming back and running this again, because I've been called out about that a few times. So I wanted to do Western States. I probably explain a bit about the race. It's the oldest 100-mile race in the world. It started in 1974, and so it runs from Olympic Valley in California through to Auburn, and it follows like a gold mining trail, and it has a net downhill course, so it's 7,000 metres accumulated descent and 5,000 metres accumulated ascent. And originally it was a horse race, which still runs today. It's called the Tevis Cup. And so
that makes more sense, horse race over 100 miles. Yeah, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
I can understand that.
And so it started in, there was a horse, one of the editions in 1973. It was Gordy Ainsley. I think it was mile 28. His horse came up lame. And so he decided to finish the race by foot. And then the following year, I think it was 80 miles at that point, it wasn't 100. The following year, he was encouraged to come back in 1974 and try and finish it in under 24 hours. And he finished it in 23 hours and 40 something minutes. And so after that, Western States was born. And so it's only every year, only like 364 people can get the opportunity to race it. And what it's pretty notorious about is the heat. So it's you start at Olympic Valley up in the high country, and then you drop down after the 50K, you go in and out of three canyons. And so if in California it's been hot the whole like month of, because it's at the end of June, if it's been hot that whole month, then those canyons just, yeah, they're pretty cooking. And so last year it was, the hottest point of the day was 41 degrees. And then this year it was 38, I think. And so, yeah, if you finish Western States, kind of, it's got a 30-hour cutoff time. So if you finish Western States in 30 hours, you get a bronze belt buckle. If you finish it under 24 hours, you get a silver belt buckle. But it's just got a really rich history, and it's kind of hard to put into words like how magical the race is, like the community that gets behind it, the volunteers, and just a journey. It's like a journey in a day. They say it's life in a day. You experience the ups and downs in life, and you can take whatever you learn into your everyday life. And yeah, I think, what else is it? Can I tell about it?
But despite the magical journey, that first experience, your feeling at the end was, I didn't really enjoy it.
The first year, it was because I'd never run. Like, the furthest I'd run before that was 120K in the Dolomites, and it was probably 14 hours. And so this was 17 and a half hours. And it's just brutal. It's like you get to 100K, and like they say, the race doesn't start till Forest Hill, which is the 100K.
Imagine being in a race that doesn't really start until 100K.
So my head's gone. My head is gone trying to like comprehend some of these things that you're saying.
Like, the crazy, the race starts at 100 kilometers. Like, what does that mean? Is there a pack of the leaders that are kind of just going through the motions, and then some of them start breaking away? Or what does that mean?
Like 100 miles is, I think, is very different to the shorter races. Like, you really have to focus on your own kind of race strategy. You can't get caught up in what anyone else is doing, because if you get caught up in what anyone else is doing, then you can totally derail your whole race. And especially 100 miles, like, absolutely anything can happen. Like, you can get like blisters, you can be, your stomach can go, you can be throwing up, you can like have the shits. Like, it's just, it's real. And especially Western States, because it's so hot, it's about managing your pace, but also managing, like, keeping your core temperature down as best you can, making sure you're eating and drinking and doing all those small things right, because if you don't, you'll just pay for it later. Like, I think last year it was, yeah, as I said, it was 41 degrees, and they had a lot of the guys, actually, they had pulled out the top men, and the woman actually did really well. But I think it comes down to, I think women were a bit better at managing ourselves or managing our egos or kind of keeping that in check. And so, yeah, last year I think they had 7 women in the top 30 or something. It might have even been 9. So, yeah.
This is maybe a weird question, but is there shit like rattlesnakes and stuff in the canyons and shit like that?
Have I seen? Yeah, we've seen snakes on training runs. They've actually even got, I think they've seen some bears before as well, but like, honestly, I think, yeah, I saw one on a training run, but you're pretty okay. Like, but I do think there is a part of the trail where a woman got killed by a cougar. There's like a memorial bench for her. I think it was a cougar, yeah, or maybe it was a mountain lion, I can't remember. But apart from that, like, that was years ago. You're fine, yeah, you don't have to worry about that.
So you go back, you decide to race it again, and you win it. At what point, obviously, like you just said, anything can happen in that race. Things can go wrong at a moment's notice. Like, at what point in the race did you know you were going to win?
When I crossed the finish line.
Yeah.
Like, you can never get to, like, think it's in the bag. Like, especially, like, my build-up going into Western States had been far from ideal. And I'd had like an Achilles thing that flared up in April, and did my, I had done my left ankle twice, and then I got COVID 5 weeks out. And so I didn't have, I really had to work on the mental side going into that race. And so I never thought I'd won it until I got onto the track at Auburn.
I'm really glad we've done the episode in this way, because you're talking about the mental side and the training you've done mentally with 10-day silent retreats in darkness. Like, those things obviously tie in hand, like it's a certain mindset which is capable of even completing these races, let alone winning them. Like, it's so impressive. What's the support network involved? And obviously you're not doing it by yourself. Like, how many people are running along with you? What does your support, your entourage look like at these things?
Yeah, so you have, over the 100-mile distance, you have 16 aid stations. And so at those aid stations, you can get like nutrition and water and also ice. So they have enough ice for every runner to have, I think it's like 4 kgs of ice per runner. Yeah, per runner per aid station. So you're stuffing ice like in a bandana, arm sleeves, like down your sports bra, just trying to get your core temperature down. And then there's certain spots, certain aid stations that you can have your crew come to. And so you have to have to make sure your crew can get to all the spots in time, you have to have kind of like two crews. And so I had David Thompson, who's a really good friend from college, didn't know anything about trail running, but was like super amped to be there. And so that was cool that he was there to help. And then I had my partner, Martin, and good friend, Alex, who they were another crew. And then the special thing about Western States is that you can have a pacer, like a pacer from the 100K point. And so they run behind you and they can just make sure you're eating, make sure you're drinking, that sort of thing. It's a very American thing to have pacers. I think not any other races around the world allow that. But so you can switch out your pacers. So Alex did the first 30K and then Martin did the last 30K.
A little bit of a detour perhaps, but we have been prompted to ask you to tell any good stories about your dad crewing. Has he been involved in the crewing side along this journey?
Or like, my dad likes to think he knows a lot about trail running, but he doesn't. Like, and so I wanted to tell, my first 100K was actually Tauwera in Rotorua. And so my mum and my dad were crewing me, and I'm not stressed when I'm racing, because it's just like, if you don't make an aid station, like, it's not the end of the world. Like, there's so many aid stations out there. I'm not going to starve. Like, I can make it work. And but dad at Tauwera was very anxious, very stressed. They got to an aid station, and then as they were leaving, he blames my mum for taking too long, but he crashed the car and took out the whole like left side of the vehicle. And so it was pretty funny. And obviously they came to Western States. They don't normally come overseas to watch me race. My dad just gets really stressed, but my partner, gave them the like, life's too short, you should come watch this. My dad, because they also, all these races are now live streamed. And so my dad's kind of with the attitude, like, I can sit in my living room and watch this, like, don't need to travel across the world to see this. But they came, and it was a very quick trip. They arrived on the Thursday, races on the Saturday. They came from New Zealand winter just to summer. And what else happened? My old man's bag didn't turn up, and they come from the West Coast and was driving on the motorways in the US, which, as I said, on Dirt Church, it's not like State Highway 73 from Greymouth to Christchurch. So it was very stressful for them before even getting to the start. And then my dad, all he knows about, he likes to drop in that about salt tablets, kind of all he knows. Like, you need to take those salt tablets, Roof.
Got to get your salt in, Roof. Cheers, Dad.
And anyway, you have all your like nutrition and like Ziploc bags. Like, this is what I need at this aid station and this aid station. And anyway, I come into an aid station, and Martin's like, it's kind of like a Formula One pit stop crew. Like, your crew's around you doing everything, so get you out of there as quick as possible. And so Martin had the Ziploc bag, and I think there's only one salt tablet that I needed to take. And then Frank saw this, my old man, and he was just turned to my mom, Claire, and goes, she's only got one salt tablet. Like, I think Martin's run out of salt tablets. And he just like went into freak out mode. And anyway, Martin kind of like had to tell him it was a one to control, and that he could calm down. But he gets so nervous about it. So they kind of, my friend David, who had to drive him around for a bit, just got him talking about trucks and distracted him. And yeah, so he didn't get so stressed.
Amazing. He sounds like quite a character. Yeah. And that's quite a nice seg. I said we'd talk about some of these other characters who've been instrumental in your running journey. John O'Wire and Eddie Gray, like these guys, I feel like there's a whole bunch of real legends in the running scene that perhaps don't get the public recognition that they deserve. But how important is it having guys, tell us a little bit about these guys and how important it is having such good quality coaches on your team?
Yeah, it's massive, and I think it goes just beyond coaching as well. Like with Jono, I reached out to him after Tarawera, I think it was 2015, because I needed a coach and I didn't know anyone at it, and he was a senior when I was a junior on the mountain running team. So I just reached out and said, hey, do you know anyone who'd be willing to coach me? And he wasn't coaching anyone at the time, but he was like, well, I'd be happy to coach you. We can give it a shot for like a month, and then if it's not working for you, you want someone different, he said, oh, he'd help me find someone. And so, yeah, it was 7 years ago and he's still coaching me. But Jono's like amazing. Like, as you said, I think he didn't get the recognition he deserves. Like, he's 6-time world mountain running champion, and the fact that he did mountain running and also like went to the Olympics in marathon, like that's very rare to have someone who does both so well. But our relationship, I think he's just a really great friend to me now. And he's a typical Kiwi, like very humble and just he's awesome. Like, and then obviously Eddie Gray, when I go back to the coast to go see him, and he's just as tough as it comes, eh? And I think like running, like even Jono used to say, like, with sponsorship and that in his day, you would just, like, if you're in the paper, you'd cut out the clipping and send it to your sponsor. And obviously it's evolved a lot since then. And it's a lot of like social media and all that, which I think if Eddie knew what running was about these days, he would probably roll his eyes. But when you go back to Eddie and see Eddie, it's very grounding. It's like, it kind of reminds you why you do this sport, and it's just that passion and love for being in the outdoors and running on trails. I always, like they say, who do you look up to? And for me, it's been definitely Jono and also Eddie. Because like Eddie back in the day, he was working full time and he would just run everywhere. It's just funny, like you'll meet up with him and he's got a hot summer's day and he's got a tracksuit top matching tracksuit bottom. Like, you'll go run up all the old mines and then get back to his house and you'll make your hot cup of tea, like his fire's going because it's heating his hot water. It's just refreshing to be around, because he's like, there's not that many people still around, I think, that are like him.
Would he occasionally turn up to training hungover?
Oh yeah, definitely. That's the only time I beat him. It was like, yeah, I remember once we were going up, he was strong in mine, I turned around, Eddie's behind me, and I was just like, oh, yeah, he's had a big night at the pub.
can we kind of glossed over him, but are we able to detour a little bit and just talk about your partner, Martin, and the support that he provides you to do all these amazing things as well? Because I've heard you speak really effusively in praise of his support as well in terms of picking you up at the end of, not specifically only picking you up in some of these massive races, but just that support that he provides to you to allow you to do the things that you do?
Yeah, he's been pretty instrumental, to be honest. And even like outside of the whole racing, like it's a lot of training leading into a big event, and he comes along for all the training runs, and yeah, he probably feels like he's my training hack all the time, and he suffers a lot probably too. But he supports me through everything, and obviously it's sometimes tricky navigating being a professional athlete, and he's got a lot of experience in the industry over 15 years, and So he's always helped with that side of it as well. And when you have moments of doubt, it's always good to have someone in your corner as well. And so I'm very fortunate that I've had him along on this ride.
Does he take the dinosaur suit everywhere he goes now?
It's actually back in Europe. I really want to bring them back, but it's just like didn't fit with all our gear. So they're in Europe for the summer.
Maybe just for those that aren't familiar with that little reference, can you shed a bit of light onto those three prehistoric creatures that seem to accompany you over the line at that win recently?
Yeah, so we went to, because Tarawera was cancelled this year, and we'd normally go up to that, and we went to Coast to Coast and to support some friends and dressed up. I was the Pink Panther and he was the Red Devil, and we saw a couple there in these blow-up pig costumes. And we thought, oh, that looks fun. Like, we really need to step up our dress-up game. And we were over, I think it was like 5 days before Western States, and kind of had this idea that it would be pretty funny to have blow up some sort of costume because you finish on an athletics track. And so we were on Amazon and came across the T-Rex kind of dinosaurs and bought three of those. And then they arrived the night before the race, which was pretty hilarious because it was like 10 o'clock at night and I should be sleeping and Martin's like running around the room, coming in and out of the bathroom in a dinosaur. But it was never a given. I was like, okay, we'll just see how the day goes. And then I think it was like up to Robbie Point, which is probably like 3K from the finish. Yeah, we said we'll do the dinos. And so Martin, he was pacing me, so he had to sprint ahead. And then the other two, David and Alex, had the dinos on the track. And then Martin jumps in a dinosaur suit, and then they chase me around the track, which was like hilarious.
I've heard you reference that term fun. Is it possible to have fun on a 100-mile race?
You got to have fun. It's like, as I said, we said at the beginning, it's like absolutely crazy what we do. Like, you're running 100 miles. If you're not having fun, you'll never make it to the finish line. Well, if it, that personally for me is my approach to it. And I think we always take life too seriously sometimes. We're all kind of on a bit of a cosmic journey. And so that's kind of when I was struggling mentally going into Western States. I worked with, he's more of an energy healer, and he kind of emphasized that it's about having fun, bringing joy into what you do, and also not being outcome dependent. So no matter what the result, don't let that impact your experience on the day. And so that's kind of what I was trying to channel. And like, I think, as I've said like before, I'm in a very like privileged position. Like, anyone who can like has the physical body to be able to run an ultra, and then also having the opportunity to get a spot into Western States, because it's really hard to get into. And yeah, I think just to be able to choose and be in a position to choose the self-inflicted suffering. So I think you sometimes got to step back and just appreciate the journey that you're on.
We kind of glossed over the mid part of the career. And so you won Old Ghost in 2020, which the 85-kilometre race, setting the new course record in the process, 4 hours ahead of Sumo Stevenson, my notes tell me. And then you've won two sort of 56K races in France, second at the World Trail Champs in 2019, won the 2018 Golden Trail Series. And then there was the Tarawera Ultra, where you were the first woman to ever win overall. And that story, for whatever reason, that was the story which seemed to really blow up. You know, you'd achieved all this other success, but it was only because you had beaten the men that perhaps you got so much attention. And I read some interesting comments at the time about that. And can you share what was your perspective on that?
Yeah, I was, to be honest, I was pretty blown away with how much kind of noise that win made. And I think when you look at it, like, you've got to put it in context, like, it was COVID, borders were shut. And this is nothing to take away from New Zealand trail runners, like the men either. It was just that there wasn't an international field like there normally is in previous years. And yeah, like, a lot of the headlines was like, woman beats men. And I just kind of questioned that at the time, that like a woman's result does not need to be like, you shouldn't compare a woman's result by like beating all the men, like a woman's result should stand on its own. But of course, like, it was great. Like, the exposure that it got, of course, like, any exposure for women in sport is a good thing. But I just thought it was important I'm on the start line and I'm racing against females. I'm not racing against the men, but sometimes, yeah, for me on that day, like, I think what was more important was that I'd beaten Courtney DeWalter's course record, and like, she's the queen, like, of ultra running. And so I was like pretty stoked about that. But what was more important was that I'd beaten all the men. And yeah, so I think it's important to sometimes question it.
What does it mean to be a professional runner at the moment? Like, are you locked into contracts sort of a year in advance? Is it 5 years? Like, do you have a future sort of sorted, or is it very much year by year? You're obviously at the top of the game right now. You're absolutely crushing it. Like, do you have some safety for the next few years?
Yeah, so the industry's changed drastically since I first entered it, and there's definitely a lot more money coming into it, and brands are really pushing trail running. And last year, Ironman bought into the UTMB World Series, and so that's pretty massive. So there has been a massive shift. And so 2 years ago, no, beginning of last year, I signed with Adidas Terex. And so, I've got a contract with them, and the support I receive from them has been great. It's a team of 34 of us from pretty much all around the world. A lot of people from Germany, because obviously HQ is out of Herzo, and it's a lot of American athletes as well. I'm just so fortunate to be on that team, because Adidas, like, if you have a goal race that you want to work towards, they really support you to kind of make the road towards it like as smooth as possible. So that's great in that sense. And we have a lot of, because kind of once I leave New Zealand, I'm living out of a suitcase for a lot. So it's kind of good to have, like, we have team camps in Austria, or we have, like, in Chamonix, they had chalets for 3 months leading up to UTMB. So you can go stay there and train. And then you have physio chefs and that come for UTMB. So there's definitely a lot of support around that. And obviously I still get help from Garmin in Taiwan. They support me, and like, even like Currens in New Zealand, they've been great. I'm pretty lucky that I can make a living out of it and get to live this life.
Are there things like appearance fees to attend races? Like, are you in high demand as like a marquee runner to attend certain races around the world?
It's like appearance fees. Some races will have them, but not a lot of them. And then there's not always a lot of prize money either in races. It more comes from your sponsors. So if you do well at certain races, like anything on the UTMB World Series or Golden Trail or that, it's your sponsor that normally will give you performance bonuses there.
Is there an expectation with these brands that you do lots of social media stuff? I feel like it's quite at odds with the sort of the West Coaster, like being off the grid. But then, you know, we are in 2022 where your Instagram presence might have an effect on how much money you're worth. Like, is that an ongoing battle?
Yeah, a lot of contracts, you'll have a performance bonus for media. That can fall back on your Instagram or your Facebook and that sort of thing. And yeah, you're right. It's something I've struggled a lot with.
It should give you someone.
When I was trying to think of an example of like things that you've learned from your parents that have kind of been ingrained in you, is one from my old man was always just like, put your head down, like do the hard work, like never bring attention to yourself, which obviously Instagram goes totally against against all of that. And even like I never even started my own Instagram account. It was my friend who set it up, and he had the password for it, and he was posting on it for me for the first bit, because I just couldn't bring myself to do a post. I was just like, I'd try and write something and just like throw my phone across the room. I was like, and even now it's just such a weird concept, to be honest. And I kind of have pretty strict rules around using social media, because yeah, it's part of the game now, so you've got to do it. But I'm still trying to work out the best way to do social media.
Hey, we're still trying to work it out too. It's not our strong suit, the old social media game, but we'll get there together.
Yeah, it's constantly changing. You'll need a PhD soon.
Yeah. So what does the future look like? Like, how long does the running career go for? Are you the sort of person that looks far into the future, or are you just taking things year by year?
Kind of take it year by year and just see. I just want to keep enjoying what I'm doing. I think I'll probably get to a point where I'm ready to be like more in one place, because you're kind of moving around so much. But yeah, I love what I do. But then at the same time, like, I race against some women that are in their early 40s and they're just still crushing it. So the timeline of being a professional ultra runner can be quite long if you want to and if you're still enjoying it.
One thing I just saw in my notes that I really wanted to ask you about, the transition, and you said someone transitioned from sort of trail running to marathon running. And I noticed your best time in the marathon's 2:34:18, which I think was just short of the time needed to qualify for the Olympics. Is like running a marathon at the Olympics something which interests you? And why is a shorter distance like that potentially harder for you to do well in than these longer distances?
Yeah, so I think I did Seoul Marathon. I think it was 2018, I think it was, or 2019, I can't remember. And I qualified for World Athletics Champs, but obviously turned that down to stick with as my sponsors in that at the time. And then I'm quite a way off the Olympic qualifying time. I think it's 2:27. I'm not even sure right now. So, but I just enjoy doing the road in the off season because I think it's important to really work on your speed. And I just like having like a change in training structure. And so, yeah, what was your question?
It was just as the Olympics, is that something that would appeal to you?
Well, it would be tricky because, like, as I said, like, I'm supported by Adidas Terex, and so I'm really committed to them, and we have a good relationship. And so I think to do well in a road marathon, you would have to block out a whole year and commit to just doing the road. And obviously I don't have that time and not really driven at the moment by the road. So kind of my heart's more into trail running.
Yeah, I can understand that. You talk about some of the places you've run. It looks like you've picked an incredible path.
Can we talk about some of those places that you've run? Like Greenland Arctic Circle sounds incredible, but mosquito-filled I found interesting to understand.
Yeah, I just kind of lucked out with that trip. I got a friend. I didn't know him super well before, but he's a journalist and photographer and writes for Trail Runner Mag and Outside magazine and the New York Times and that, and he's pretty cunning. He kind of plans all these like trips that he wants to do, and they're pretty awesome, a lot of them. And so he gets in touch with the tourism board, and so he'll take photos and stuff. And I got invited on this trip with another friend, and so we started at the ice cap, and it was all up. I think it was like 200K, and then we in Greenland, and then we went through to out to the ocean. Heading west, and yeah, it was definitely we were expecting, because obviously it's boggy tundra, so you're expecting like mosquitoes and that, but we just had one day that was like really bad. We had to wear head nets because we couldn't, there are huts, and so yeah, you'd sleep in the huts and you couldn't be outside long at all. Get mauled.
The other one, like, we've mentioned the Mount Everest Tenzing Hillary Ultra that you've done. There was another two on my list, which I weren't sure whether they were gags or not, and I'm hoping that they're genuine ultra races, which is the Antarctica Ultra and the Amazon Jungle Ultra. Are they like two legit ones that you could actually do?
I haven't done those.
No, I know you haven't done them, but are they real ones?
They are, and the guy Tommy who's doing that I ran with today, he's done it's called the Five Deserts, I think. So I think one of them is in Antarctica. So he's done that race. It's obviously, those ones are really expensive as well. So you've got to have a good sponsor for that.
Amazon Jungle Ultra sounds horrendous.
Yeah. But you know, as ultra runners, we're suckers for punishment. So,
are those two on the bucket list then? Are they ones to tick off before you hang up your running shoes?
Not really, to be honest. Like, you're pretty focused on, like, at the moment, the more like the competitive, pretty like ones on the UTMB World Series. Right, but so, never say never.
So maybe. Those like gimmick ones?
Yeah. They're not gimmick ones. They're just different. It's a different experience.
Right.
Yeah.
Speaking of hanging up your shoe, like, how many pairs of shoes do you blow out on? Like, is it a brand new pair of shoes when you start one of those new like races, or are they got 300K on the tread, or just nuts and bolts questions fascinate me about how the life of a long distance runner.
How many K? I probably wear a pair for like a month, and so you can be running in them like in a week. I'd be anywhere between 100 or at the most 160K, and you kind of. I never wear just the one kind of shoe. You kind of rotate between different types of shoe depending on what terrain or what sort of training you're doing. And so, yeah, you definitely do have a lot of shoes. They're all stored at my parents' place, so which they said they're going to have to start charging me rent soon.
Some of the ground we've covered on this ep has been amazing. It's been so captivating, like the mindset, the places you've been, the races that you've done, the wins you've achieved. It's just incredible. It's really blown me away. So thank you so much. I'm going to start to attempt to wrap us up. Shay's our big outro guy, but he's probably got a few bits and pieces before then. But when will we see you next in action, and when will you be back in New Zealand next?
Yeah, so I'm heading back to New Zealand on next Thursday, and kind of I'm not too sure about next year's plan. So because I'm doing UTMB, which is end of August, and it's a very different style race to Western States, where I think I mentioned it's 170K with 10,000 meters of vert, and I come from probably a bit of more of a running background, so I need to get really good at using poles and hiking a bit more. So. I'll do a Madeira Island Ultra Trail in April, and then I'm not sure what I'll do over the New Zealand summer. But I think we're thinking of doing the Te Araroa, the South Island segment, in pieces over the summer. But hopefully I'll do some New Zealand races, probably either Tarawera or Old Ghost again.
Does Old Ghost hold a special place in your heart, given its kind of home territory?
Oh, definitely. Like I've raced all over the world, but I think Old Ghost is definitely up there as one of the best races. It's really well organized, but I think like Phil Roster and his team, they've just made it really special. And it's not just about the people who finish at the front of the field. They acknowledge everyone who's made that journey from Seddonville to Lyle, and like they have an award for. The oldest competitor, they get an aged bowl of gin, I think it is, and then the youngest competitor gets a colouring in book and crayons. And then I think it's the last 10 people get the award for the longest day out. And so I just think that's really important. It's grassroots, and it reminds you why you do this sport, and if you want to know a bit more about ultra running, I think it's you just go to a finish line and you see what people have gone through to get to that finish line, and especially the people at the back of the pack, like they're the heroes. Like often they have family, they have a full-time job, but they're committed to training for this ultra and like an elite, like this is my job. And so you're out there for an ultra, you'll be finished in maybe 17 hours, and you don't have to go overnight. And then someone further down near the tail end, they're out in the conditions for a whole nother night. Got like so many more hours to get more blisters, more chafage. And so I think it's pretty amazing what they have to go through. It's just at Les Templiers, which is a race in the south of France. And we were watching the last finishers come in. And then there was this guy called Julian, and he crosses the finish line. He'd just made the cutoff, and he just starts crying. And his wife and two young daughters go around him, hugging him, and they're all crying too. And we learned he had been training. He lived in the area, and he had lost a significant amount of weight and had been training for the past 10 years to be able to finish Les Templiers. And so it's just stories like that. Like you hear of people like overcoming cancer, and they set themselves this goal to finish an ultra or like always remember Rob Henderson at Old Ghost Ultra, 70, I would say he's 72, and he finishes 85K, and I'm just like, I like look up to people like him because wow. I just hope when I'm 72, I'm still out there and enjoying it the same that he is.
That's insane. 72, yeah, 85, that's insane.
Yeah. And even they call it the golden hour at Western States, like the last hour before cutoff. And I think, I don't know if it was this year or last year, I can't remember, but there was a guy, he was 72 and he finished the 100 miles and 2 minutes before the cutoff.
Oh, wow. So
it's just like, and everyone comes and watches the golden hour, just comes and supports everyone and helps get them across the finish line. So I know we're a crazy bunch, but it's pretty special what can happen when you set yourself a goal of running an ultra or even running a trail race.
That's so cool. It's so amazing the experiences you've had and the places you've been. You have to let us know if your runs ever take you to the beautiful Hamilton. I'm not sure if you heard of it, and the Waikato, you know, around the lake or something. Maybe stop in for a coffee. But anyway, Shay's our outro guy, so I'm sure he's got something good lined up, Shay.
Yeah, I'm. To be honest, I've spent a long period of this podcast just listening to what you say, and what you've done, and your outlook on life and your views on life. And I think it seems like a combination of one, your upbringing, but two, the amazing community that you're involved in. In terms of what I find interesting is that we didn't even get into it, but I understand that you're continuously offering support to people like Josh, to people like Kerry Souter, who we didn't even talk about in any detail on this episode. But I feel like you get strength and energy back from that community and from those people. And the meditation stuff at the top end of this episode has just blown me away in terms of that strength of mind to get through that. But the gratitude was the thing that stuck with me. The gratitude of when you come out of these things, be it meditation or a 100-mile run, about the simple things that you have and that you're lucky enough to have in terms of being able to run or being able to move or being able to do these things. And we probably take that for granted a lot of the time. So amazing to hear your outlook on life and your philosophies. And while it's not anything that's within my sphere of normality, the way that you talk about it and the way that you normalize it makes it something that I think is really easy to digest and understand. So thank you very much for sharing that with us. Everybody that we spoke to said that you're an amazing human, and I can't help but agree with them, and look forward to hopefully meeting you some place in real life somewhere along the line as we drive past you on your last 100 bloody K of whatever race that you're doing.
Well, also, yeah, if you ever come to the coast, get in touch and we'll take you to the Brunner Mine Bridge and see if
yes,
we can.
Yes, 100%, 100%.
We can accept you into the West Coast community or not.
Cheers, Ruth. It's been awesome. Thanks so much for giving us your time.
Yeah, thank you guys too. Yeah, I'm really, really pleased we've made this happen.
Thanks, Ruth, and you were definitely throwing elbows. Anyway, as Steve and Seamus said, have a look at the video evidence if you want to know truth. Look, thank you to Steve and Seamus. Thank you to the Between Two Bears podcast. We really, really appreciate that, and we hope that you enjoyed listening to it.
Thank you very much for tuning in. We're on social media at Dirt Church Radio. You can email us at dirtchurchradio@gmail.com. You can find us on all the podcast platforms. Like and follow if you fancy, and you can download direct from the website, which is dirtchurchradio.com.
Don't forget to write in with your greatest run ever. We'd love to hear from you, and you can read them on our website, which is dirtchurchradio.com. And then, having read them, send one in to us, dirtchurchradio@gmail.com.
Thanks to our sponsors, Scott Running, For the Faster, and Cieli. Thank you to our patrons, and Wild Things, and thanks to our editor, Kieran. Stay tuned next week. We've got another great show lined up for our summer series.
Mā te wā. Thanks, Rigby.